Our speaker today is Radek Sikorski. He is at the moment a senior fellow at Harvard, but of course, as pretty well I'm sure everyone in this hall will know, he has the most distinguished record, having been Poland's Minister of Defense from 2005 to 2007, Foreign Minister from 2007 to 2014, and then Speaker of Parliament for 2014 and 15. So an extraordinary combination. You could say he is Poland's nearest equivalent to a combination of Lord Palmerston and John Bercow. And each can come to their own judgment as exactly what I was implying by that remark. Radek, also before he became a minister, he served as a war reporter in Afghanistan and Angola from 2001 to 2005, many other things I could mention, which I won't because it will take me far, far too long. But Foreign Policy magazine named him, when he was foreign minister, as one of the 100 global policy intellectuals, and they said, for speaking the truth, even when it is not always diplomatic. I remember Harold Macmillan in his memoirs. Harold Macmillan was foreign minister for a short period. He said foreign ministers are always in a cruel dilemma because of the sensitivity of the subjects they deal with. He said their speeches hover between the cliché and the indiscretion. And then he went on to say they're either dull or dangerous. Well, Radek is neither dull, but he's certainly not dull. Whether he's dangerous or not, we'll wait to hear what he has to say. But just as an example of how he has been willing to, as it were, stretch the boundaries of what diplomacy normally implies, he's very much remembered when he was foreign minister for having said on a particular occasion in relation to Germany, he said, I must be the first Polish foreign minister who has ever said, I fear German power less than German inactivity. Well received in Germany, obviously it could have been very controversial in Poland, but he nevertheless said that. And so essentially what we have today as our speaker, there are many politicians around the world, but there are not that many statesmen. And Radek is a statesman because he rises above the purely political day-to-day considerations. And today he's going to speak to us on a subject highly relevant, European Union foreign policy, security and defence after Brexit, the view from Europe. Radek.
Thank you, Malcolm, for that generous introduction. But I'd like to say that if I'm anything by comparison with British politics, I'm Poland's Sir Malcolm Rifkind, having been defense minister and foreign minister. It's a very exclusive club of people who've held both great offices of state, and I'd be very proud to be known as that. Thank you, and let me plunge in by saying that the state of Europe's foreign policy and Europe's defense policy is not good. And I put to you that this is for a fundamental constitutional reason. Namely, as I see it, the European Union is the world's only existing confederation with some federal features. I'll explain my terms. I understand a confederation to be an arrangement in which members stick together for certain purposes. They make treaties, they make rules, but the ultimate sovereignty lies in the member states. And in a federation, ultimate sovereignty lies at the center. And the center can actually enforce the obeying of the rules. And so when you look at the various crises that the European Union is grappling with, I put to you that the problem is with the Constitution, but exactly the opposite of what British Eurosceptics think. Namely, it is not that the centre has too much control, but too little. Look at the Euro crisis. It's because member states broke the Growth and Stability Pact. look at the Schengen crisis, it is because some member states proved unable to enforce the external perimeter of the border of the zone. And it is the same with foreign and security policy. Members agree rules, and then they cheat. We established the Office of Europe's High Representative for Foreign Policy under the Treaty of Lisbon. And as you know, the first commissioner, Vice President of the Commission and High Representative was a British politician, Baroness Ashton. And she created Europe's diplomatic service. But the idea in the Lisbon Treaty was that member states would come together in the Foreign Affairs Council, agree their joint positions on the big issues of the day, policy towards Russia, towards China, what might you, and then the High Representative would carry it out. And on those issues that the member states agreed to have a joint policy, member states would let the High Representative carry out the policy. But you know what happened. The High Rep is trying to do that, another capable lady, but member states have not given up their foreign policy in those areas. So, for example, if you go to the Middle East, Israel, or elsewhere, leaders are astonished by the fact that they are having to deal with the representative of the EU and then national ministers as well. So we haven't aggregated our foreign policy. We have just added another player whom we are not empowering to be effective. And as a result, despite the best efforts of Baroness Ashton and Federica Mogherini, the EU is not in the lead on any important policy, be it even in its neighborhood, be it Ukraine, where we now have a Minsk process where Germany and France, who are not even neighbors of either Russia or Ukraine, are in the lead, or whether on Iran, or whether on Libya, the EU is playing a supportive rather than a leading role. And it's quite similar in defense policy. It was actually an excellent British idea to have the EU organize battle groups to specialize. We've had British officials running Europe's defense agency, which was heroically trying to coordinate some of member states' procurement policies so that the considerable amount of money that member states spend on defense is spent more rationally. But in the end, on those matters, member states are very jealous of their sovereignty, and the policy is honored in breach rather than as a matter of course. And this, I think, is a great pity, because on defense in particular, Britain could have led the EU. Britain has been and it still is the most serious country in defense capabilities, and therefore, if Britain chose to lead EU efforts, normally member states would differ. But just like in diplomacy, you have spurned the leadership role. In fact, when I was proposing to fulfill the permanent structured cooperation that is contained in the Lisbon Treaty, Britain was the country that vetoed it time and again. Britain vetoed the creation of a joint headquarters, and I was told very pointedly by British officials, Britain will never serve. British units will never, ever serve under an EU flag. Despite the fact, of course, that British soldiers do serve under the EU flag, just not as units. And Britain's history of involvement in EU mission is long and distinguished. There have been some successes, and not only soft missions, quasi-policing missions, all over Africa. But for example, during the Operation Atalanta, Baroness Ashton went down to the operations center and gave the order to the EU task force, which included Britain's component and was actually operationally commanded from Northwood, I think, gave the order to strike kinetically at the Somali pirates off the coast of the Horn of Africa. And the strike was a big success. The incidence of piracy dropped by about 70% for a couple of years. But, you know, you see, we didn't even advertise it. Most people don't know that it ever happened. We don't have the pictures of Cathy Ashton doing that, like we have the pictures of Obama and Clinton watching in real time the strike on Osama bin Laden. Which is a pity, because I think successful military operations build a sense of pride. Now, the reason why Britain has been so reluctant to embrace EU's foreign and particularly defense policy is that Britain has consistently felt that it could be at the expense of NATO, that it would duplicate NATO capabilities and by excluding the Americans might actually do more harm than good. That may have been the case one day, but I would argue that today we have a new situation. My view from the continent is a Polish view from the continent, and as we see it, NATO and the continent has two strategic directions, dimensions, if you like. The eastern flank, where after President Putin unfortunately broke the post-war taboo and changed borders by force on the pretext of protecting compatriots abroad, we have a revisionist Russia. But Russia is a serious military power. For example, anti-aircraft capability. Any conflict with Russia would not be like a conflict in the Middle East. Russia is a nuclear power and all that. And therefore, deterring Russia is a serious, traditional, territorial defense issue that only NATO can deal with. And I'm very glad that since then, first under President Obama, the Eastern Flank, only after 10 years of our membership in NATO, got the contingency plans how to defend the eastern flank, and now we have rotational presence, which I feel is sufficient to reassure us, but not so big as to alarm Russia. We have most of the time two brigades on rotation. You cannot invade Russia with two brigades. So Russia has no reason to feel alarmed. Russia dealt with 100 divisions rather successfully. And that contribution, including by Britain in the Baltic states, is hugely appreciated. And then we have the southern dimension, where I think we agree all over the continent that preventing mass migration is an existential issue for the European Union. Because if the southern perimeter of the EU, of the Schengen zone, is not protected, then via the political system, the EU will actually be torn apart by populists. We have staved off the crisis, migration is down to a pre-crisis level, but we now know that it's a huge task. And it's a task that I think is reasonable to say, in whose fulfillment we cannot count on the United States for very good reasons. Just like the United States would not call on us to help them police their border with Mexico, why should we? So they think, you are the richest, biggest economy on earth, you need to protect your own border from at least your near neighborhood. And I think they are right. Protecting the Mediterranean is something that the EU should be capable of. because it's a task not just military, it's also, of course, border guards, it's developmental, it's humanitarian, it has all these dimensions, in some of which Europe has considerable capability and assets. So I'm very glad that the new multi-annual budget of the European Union has increased funding for Europe's border guards tenfold. We're taking this extremely seriously. And it seems to me that it makes sense for member states to serve in Frontex both on the southern maritime border and eastern land border of the EU. In the south, we are helping Italy, Spain, Greece in particular. In the east, we are sending the message to our eastern neighbors, look, this is not just the border of Poland, of Lithuania, of Latvia, this is the border of the EU. And don't even think about breaching it. And so there is a mutual interest. And we now know from the experience of the exodus from Turkey to Greece that it's actually very difficult to intercept people smuggling boats at sea. That in order to really prevent piracy or people smuggling, you need to have effective control of the other side of the water. And that, I could imagine, could be a mission for the EU. If, for example, Libya continued to be unstable, if Mr. Putin tried another, after Syria, to destabilize another country and perhaps use the issue migration against us, as he's done before, I'm convinced. But I despair of the current defense arrangements in the EU of being efficient. The battle groups have not yet been used. For a reason. In most countries, unlike in Poland and unlike in the EU, in the UK, the use of armed force abroad is strictly controlled by parliaments, particularly in Germany, for good historical reasons. And if we, as successive defense ministers in Poland, we resisted putting it under parliamentary control, because if you put it under democratic control, the truth of the matter is, you could probably never use it. Because using force is always expensive, dangerous, and unpopular. Our argument is, when we are threatened, we don't want them to have votes in their parliaments whether to help us. We want them to send tanks. But because of this, the battle groups are difficult to use. Which is why when I propose permanent structured cooperation in the EU. My idea was to have a serious club of countries that really want to fight and to have a vehicle that would not just be usable, but that would actually overcome some of the difficulties we have in NATO. And the difficulties, as I see it, that we have in NATO is, number one, the incentives are wrong. Costs fall where they lie, which means that if there is an operation and you participate, you put your soldiers at harm's way, but you're also out of pocket. If you don't participate, you're sitting pretty and you save money. So under my idea of PESCO, and I proposed this officially during the Polish presidency, was number one, operations should be financed from the common fund. Number two, the problem we have in NATO is that every country has different rules of engagement. So when you are running an operation as a commander, it's almost impossible to know which contingents to use in what circumstances. This was our experience in Iraq. When we were just north of the British sector, we were in command of the Division Central South with 26 nations. And every one of them had different rules of engagement. That's not a way to run a war. And number three, it should be the club of countries that can actually send troops at short notice. Which, of course, means that some EU member states couldn't do it, because some are neutral and some have constitutional breaks on the use of military force. But the idea was that it should be first exclusive, and if it proves popular, then we broaden. What the EU has done is the opposite, invited everyone, but hopefully there will be some kind of avant-garde group, as usual in European integration, that will set practical standards. And let me now move to the third and final section of what I want to tell you, namely how Britain can fit in future. Well, first of all, Brexit is many things, but at one level, and it's one of the pleasures of being out of office, that one can veer towards dangerous. to my mind, Brexit proves that recent empires that have not been defeated in war, and it's not just Britain, it's also Russia, it's also Turkey, are psychologically incapable of living under rules over which they do not exercise national control. France, of course, is the exception because she was defeated in war. We all got defeated in some kind of war on the continent in the 20th century, and France compensates by trying to run the European Union. So Britain wants to run its own shop, which is understandable for historical reasons. And now the question is to what extent it will be able to do that after Brexit. And here I think it's going to be tough, because I think the relationship between the continent and post-Brexit Britain will be governed by the rules of Newtonian physics. Namely, mass matters, and the attraction and the pulling power depends on your mass. And Britain is 15% of the EU economy. And, you know, it's the moon that goes around the Earth and not the other way around. And we both go around the sun, and the question is, for this century, whether the sun will continue to be the United States or whether it will be China. But that's another issue. And to prove what I mean, you only need to look at the state of Brexit negotiations. I'm sorry, I'll do it with an anaesthetic, okay? If you look at the EU's agreed joint position, and you look at UK's red lines, the EU's position has not shifted an inch, and it won't. The UK is having to move its red lines for the agreement to be possible. And that, I put to you, will be the story of the relationship. It's number one because of the differences of potential, but also, and this here I think there was a failure of statesmanship, it's also because in the EU we have possibly lost the ability to change our treaties. Because if you remember, in free trade agreement with Canada almost stumbled because of a vote in a regional Belgian parliament. So when Britain says, and is sometimes right, that the EU should change its treaties for the new circumstances, it's actually almost impossible. And therefore, Britain will mostly have to adjust to what the EU does. And by not having a vote, we'll lose some influence over, for example, CSDP missions, which hitherto have benefited from Britain's participation and Britain's participation in decisions. Now, Britain has some advantages that it could still deploy. I think it's a major power in finance, but I think you will find that if you don't clean up London as regards money laundering, eventually EU will legislate against you. And the second advantage is, of course, the British Armed Forces. Don't overplay it, because you have reduced your military very substantially. Poland has more fighting men than you. We have four times the number of tanks. You could deploy, I'm told, there are military men here, so please correct me. But I'm told on a mission longer than 6 months, i.e. if you need a rotation, you could deploy one brigade to the continent. Without a rotation, two brigades. Poland has 10, and we're much closer to the potential area of conflict. So your advantage I think the air power is difficult to deploy, as I mentioned already, against the potential adversary. And therefore, we are left with the nuclear deterrent, which is pretty unusable, and last, the Navy. Now, my working assumption, I'm speaking purely for myself, is that just as there has not been in history a deployment of a British carrier to the Baltic Sea, so there won't be in future. And we've lost and won our wars on land. So I'm speaking out of without expertise. But I'm told by people who know that the Baltic is simply too small and too shallow, and your carrier would be too vulnerable. So you're not going to deploy it. Carrier in the North Sea doesn't make much sense, because you can fly those aircraft from the island. So you can deploy your future aircraft carriers either in the North Atlantic, but who is the adversary, or in the Mediterranean. And here, your two carriers are double the combined carrier force of the rest of the European Union. Here, you would be incredibly valuable if it came to those kinds of operations that would be needed to secure North Africa. And so I think Britain, my argument was before the referendum, but I think it's gained force since then. My argument was, whatever the outcome of the referendum, Britain should become the leader of Europe's defense efforts. Because you have the reputation, you have the capabilities, and you have other members' inclination to follow your lead. That would be my recommendation, which would be somewhat what Poland is doing. As members, we were not, and still are not, members of the currency union. But we were compensating it and burnishing our European credentials by being enthusiastic supporters of another important area of EU integration, and that was defence. You could do that too. Of course, it's going to be much harder from a position of a third country. It seems like the die is cast. The best thing, as far as I'm concerned, would be for Britain to, having examined what the consequences are, to change its mind. I recognize how unlikely it is, but I would still recommend that a strong role in facing up to the dangers that we have in common would be an honorable and influential role for Britain after Brexit. Thank you.